You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue. And this hour is going to continue with the same audio that that you heard in hour one, just more of it. For those of you who bear with me, for those of you who were with us yesterday, this is the helicopter pilot, and to me, this is the guy. This is the guy that you pattern the whole. You pattern the whole event after. Can you be Hugh Thompson? Would you land your helicopter to stop this? Can you be that guy? Can you be that woman? Can you be that Marine? Can you be that soldier? And so, again, more astounding video. You know, amazing.
During the mission, as it was going on, we kept just reconning around, started seeing a lot of bodies.
Okay, now just so you know, he's a pilot. He's got two crew members. They're gunners. One's a crew chief. One's a gunner. One's killed shortly thereafter. The other one appears with him in public later as he speaks. And I think and you'll hear him shortly in one of those Kiowa small helicopters. They'd be buzzing around just over the treetops. FON, spotting, scouting, things like that. So that's what his job is on this day.
It didn't add up, you know, how people were getting killed and wounded, and we weren't receiving any fire. Just, you know, it didn't make sense. There was too many casualties there, and how they were. The locations they were in, you know, Fiat artillery couldn't do this because there were, you know, bodies in places the artillery didn't hit trying to get out of the village.
The radio traffic recorded between command helicopters betrays no knowledge of the slaughter that Warrant Officer Thompson was witnessing as he hovered just above ground. Between 9:30 and 10 o'clock, when he saw GIs advancing on another group of defenseless women and children, Thompson ordered his crew to turn their guns on their fellow Americans. Larry Coben was Thompson's door gunner.
Warrant Officer Thompson was desperate to get these civilians, what he believed to be civilians, out of this bunker and into a safe area. He'd seen beforehand that what he was trying to do to help the people on the ground wasn't getting done. He was convinced that the ground forces would kill these people if he couldn't get to them first. He landed the aircraft in between the American forces and the Vietnamese people in the bunker. Got out of the aircraft, had us get out of the aircraft with our weapons to cover him, and he went and had words with the lieutenant on the ground. He asked the lieutenant how he could get these people out of the bunker. The lieutenant said the only way he knew was with hand grenades. So when Warrant Officer Thompson came back to the aircraft, he was furious. And he was desperate to get these people out of the bunker. He told us he was going over to the bunker himself to see if he could get them out. I don't even think he took a rifle with him. I think he was, besides a sidearm, he was relatively unarmed. He told us if the Americans were to open fire on these Vietnamese as he was getting them out of the bunker, that we should return fire on the Americans.
When I did instruct my crew, chief and gunner, you know, to open up on them if they open up on any more civilians, I don't know how I'd have felt if they would have opened up on them. But that particular day, I wouldn't have given it a second thought. They were the enemy at that time, I guess. They were damn sure the enemy to the people on the ground.
With the aid of larger helicopter gunships, Hugh Thompson and his crew succeeded in airlifting to safety over a dozen old men, women, and children.
The first time the Americans came, the children followed them. They gave the children sweets to eat. Then they smiled and left. We don't know their language. They smiled and said, okay. So we learned okay. The second time they came, we poured them water to drink. They didn't say anything. The third time they killed everyone. Killed everybody, destroyed everything. Nothing was left.
This monument marks the ditch where the largest numbers of people were executed. Scores of people, rounded up in sweeps of the village, were herded here to be shot by Lieutenant Kelly and others acting on his orders.
The people were chased into the ditch like ducks. They were crying, "Oh God, have pity, please let me up. We're innocent, have pity." They shot all the people dead. Then silence. Tiny children crawling along the edge of the ditch. It broke your heart. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. I was injured. So I crawled here back home. Over there was a naked woman who had been raped. And a virgin girl with her vagina slit open. We don't know why they behaved like that.
Deer and flying around. We came across a ditch. It had bodies in it, a lot of them. Women, kids, old men. I remember thought going through my mind, how did these people get in the ditch? And I finally thought about the Nazis, I guess, and marching everybody down into the ditch and blowing them away. Here we are, supposed to be the good guys in the white hats. It upset me. As we were flying over it one time, we noticed, you know, some movement in it. And Andrada, who was my crew chief, spotted a child moving around amongst, you know, the bodies that were in there. So we landed the aircraft next to the ditch, and we got out of it, and my gunner, you know, stood on one side of the aircraft and I stood on the other. And Gerardo went down wading, you know, through the bodies and brought back up, you know, a little child about 3 years old. It was obvious how the people got in the ditch by then, I guess. So we got the child on board, and we were, you know, getting that child out of there. There was more we probably could have saved, but we, you know, couldn't carry it. So we flew the child to Quangai Hospital, I believe it was, and dropped it off with a nun there. It was a very sober flight going over there, very quiet. Trying to figure it out. I was looking at the kid, which I thought was a boy about 4 years old, 3 years old. I had a son at home, same age. I was thinking that it could be your kid. It was a quiet flight. Later found out in some investigations and hearings that it was actually a girl. And you really couldn't tell. We checked arms and legs, you know. There's no bullet wounds. still hurts to think about us doing things like that.
That's 20 years later, and he's a good guy. As I said, you know, the audio is absolutely, you know, mind-blowing.
Thì chợt nghe tiếng chị của la. Trong nhà cũng như
I looked out of the house and I saw my sister, Mui. She was 14 at the time. I apologize. Some of this is a repeat from yesterday. An American was pressing on top of her. She had no clothing on her. At the time, I didn't understand what that meant. My sister was trying to resist him. Afterwards, the American got up. He put his clothes on. And then he shot her. Never, O Americans, Americans. I decided to leave my hiding place. I saw my house had burned completely. And in the yard, my loved ones were burned to death. My mother and my little brother. Still in my mother's arms. My 7-month-old brother. Whose body was half burned. I didn't know anything anymore. I stood by my mother's body and cried.
As a professional soldier, I had been taught to carry out the orders.
Now, this is one of the squad leaders.
And at no time it ever crossed my mind to disobey or to refuse to carry out an order that was issued by my superiors.
So if one of your men...
What's truly astounding about this is the whole concept. This is a non-commissioned officer. The whole concept of what a lawful order is. And I don't know, after all these years, clinging to this idea absolves you of responsibility of what happened to be able to say, I just carried out orders. But, you know, the non-commissioned officer saying this kind of stuff is mind-blowing. But more than one says it.
Had refused to shoot, what would have happened to him? What would you have said to him?
If one of my men had refused to shoot, I shudder to think what had been the repercussions, because it's hard to say now what I would have done, looking back. At the time that it actually, if it had, when it happened, he would have been in serious trouble.
Okay.
There's this concept of serious trouble that you're going to be court-martialed or maybe even shot on the spot. The one casualty that this company takes during this is he's a radio operator, and he's medevaced for a gunshot wound to the foot. And I saw the picture, and I said, that's self-inflicted. He did that to get his ass out of there. And then yesterday in the investigation, it's exactly what they said. Gunshot wound, self-inflicted, so he could get out of there.
Out of trouble.
He could have faced court-martial. He could have been shot on the spot for refusing an order in face of the enemy, in face of hostile fire. Someone refuses to carry out an order, he's in trouble.
But there was no hostile fire.
At the time, we didn't realize that there was no hostile fire at the time.
So are you suggesting that if one of your troops had refused to shoot, shall we say, an old woman or a young child at My Lai on that day, that they would have faced disciplinary action?
They most definitely would have faced disciplinary action had they refused to fire or kill or carry out the orders, yes.
But these were young kids. Most of them had never killed anybody before. I mean, to kill a child seems a monstrous thing. Why were these people able to do this without questioning it?
I feel that they were able to carry out the assigned task, the orders, that meant killing small kids, killing women, because they were soldiers. They were trained that way. They was trained that when you get into combat, it's either you or the enemy. And
so fucking crazy to hear this, you know? That somehow or other killing innocent people, you know, is okay. Unarmed, innocent people. Shit, you can't even kill unarmed combatants.
And they would, the people that were in that village, the women, the little kids, the old men, were all considered the enemy.
So, leaving aside the question of following orders, do you think that that order was morally right, and that the actions of the troops that followed that order, yourself included, were behaving in a moral fashion?
I feel that we carried out the orders in a moral fashion, and the orders of destroying the village, of killing the people in the village, I feel that we carried out our orders, and I feel that we did not violate any moral standards.
This GI was the only American casualty at My Lai. He'd accidentally shot himself. Despite the total absence of hostile fire.
The truth is, that wasn't no accident. Did it on purpose.
Callie continued to order his men to shoot. Most obeyed. A few refused.
Lieutenant Callie ordered certain people.
Okay, now this is, again, 20 years later. He's probably close to 40 years old. Black soldier. And I want to say the interview's done someplace in Arkansas.
To shoot these people, and I was one of them, and I refused. And he told me that he was going to have me a court-martial when we got back to base camp. And I told him what was on my mind at the time. Ordering me to shoot down innocent people, that's not an order. That's craziness to me, you know? And so I don't feel like I have to obey that.
Hold on, I'll give you his name.
And so I don't feel like I have to obey that.
To give his name.
At the time. Ordered me to shoot down.
His name's Harry Stanley. Just a 11 Bravo in Charlie Company. He knew it.
Down innocent people, that's not an order. That's craziness to me, you know? And so I don't feel like I have to obey that.
Listen,
and if you want
to
court martial me, you do that. You can get away with it. I feel like it was horrible, you know, just a terrible thing to be going on, and American boys doing this, you know. And I feel like I'm a red-blooded American boy, just like any of the rest of the guys that was there, you know. And to see that, I'm talking about black or white, you know, black and white guys doing this, you know, it didn't make any difference, I'm saying. It just seemed like a horrible thing. I'm telling you, we all came from the same place. To me, you know, we all came from the same place. And I know they all had to have the same values that I had somewhere along the line. If they didn't get it in school, they had to get it in religion, church, or someplace, you know. If you didn't go to school, you know, you could pick it up from a stranger, you know. It's just simple, you know. But then to go and do something like this, It's immoral to me, you know. That's just the way I feel about it.
Private Michael Bernhardt was another of the GIs who refused to shoot civilians.
I thought that
most of the values that people held were pretty solid, that when we defined things as being good and bad, that they were good or bad. Killing a bunch of civilians in this way, babies, women, old men, people who were unarmed, helpless, was wrong. Every American would know that. And yet, this company, sitting out here, isolated in this one place, didn't see it that way. I'm sure they didn't. What people think of you back home don't matter. This group of people that they were with was all that matters. It was the whole world. What they thought was right was right, and what they thought was wrong was wrong. Courage was seen as stupidity. Cowardice was cunning and wariness. And cruelty and brutality was sometimes seen as heroic. That's the way things began and started to change, and that's what it eventually turned into.
By 11:30, when Charlie Company broke for lunch, they had killed around 400 people. Newspapers in America hailed a significant victory, with many enemy dead. For over a year, what really happened at My Lai remained hidden from the outside world.
Gentlemen.
All right, let me stop this. This guy's name is Rittenour. Anyway, he's not there. He hears about this story. He writes these letters after he gets out of the army. But in the meantime, there's been the aviation brigade reports have gone to the AmeriCal division that say hundreds of people have been killed. The advisor reports have bubbled up. They've been dismissed. It's honestly incredible. And it was really interesting hearing General Hackworth or Colonel Hackworth talk about General Pierce, who led the investigation. He said, you know, you could tell, you know, from talking to Pierce how despondent he was about the state of the Army. That how many different opportunities there was to investigate this and how it was never looked at.
It was late in April 1968 that I first heard of Paintville and what allegedly happened there. I received that first report with some skepticism, but in the following months I was to hear similar stories from such a wide variety of people that it became impossible for me to disbelieve that something rather dark and bloody did indeed occur sometime in March 1968 in a village called Pinkville in the Republic of Vietnam.
With this letter sent to leading members of Congress, America began to learn the truth about My Lai. Its author was an ex-GI who'd heard about the massacre while serving in Vietnam.
When I sat down with a friend who had been there 3 weeks after the massacre, and we were telling each other war stories, and we hadn't seen each other in 3 months, and I said, "What have you been doing?" He said, "What have you been doing?" He said, "Oh, man, did you hear what we did at Pinkville?" I said, "No, what'd you do at Pinkville?" He said, "We went in there and we killed everybody." I said, "Killed everybody? What do you mean?" He said, "We just shot them, lined them up and shot them down. 300, 400, 500 people. I don't know how many." And my immediate reaction was, you know, these no good sons of bitches. Look what they've gotten me into. Look what they've gotten us all into. They left me now with a choice to turn in my friends or to be a part of this horrible crime. And I'm not going to be a part of this horrible crime. The only way to not be a part of the horrible crime is to discover the truth and to pursue it.
Clear moral compass, right? Black and white to him. Very interesting.
And let the chips fall wherever they land. And that's what I set out to do. The smaller massacres, the murders of one and two and three people at a time, allowed you to evade the truth of what you were involved in. When you murder a village of 500 people, or you know that a village of 500 people has been murdered in one afternoon, in one morning, it's pretty tough to evade the reality of that and the implications of that. One of my friends, when he told me about it, said, you know, it was this Nazi kind of thing. And that's exactly right. It was this Nazi kind of thing. We didn't go there to be Nazis. At least none of the people I knew went there to be Nazis. I didn't go there to be a Nazi.
News of the massacre spread a wave of horror around the world. In America, initial incredulity turned quickly to shame and national anguish. As the inquiries and trials began, the men of Charlie Company emerged to public scrutiny. Sergeant David Mitchell, accused of shooting people at the ditch site in My Lai.
I'm not guilty.
Charlie Company's commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina.
Listen to this. Medina is the one who told them to kill everybody. And when asked women and children, he said everybody. Hugh Thompson saw him walk over to a wounded woman laying in a field and shoot her in the chest. Listen to Medina here.
I can further say that I did not see any slaughter at My Lai 4 that day.
This is an officer in the United States fucking military.
And none was reported to me. And I'll further state that I did not order any massacre at My Lai 4.
Lieutenant William Kelly, originally charged with 109 murders. Kelly came to embody the issues at the heart of the case. His defense, that he was only following orders, evoked disturbing comparisons with the Nazis at Nuremberg. Meanwhile, army investigators returned to My Lai as part of a massive inquiry, which was to put the facts of the massacre beyond dispute. The original list of charges drawn up by the Army's Criminal Investigation Department left no doubt about the nature of Charlie Company's operations in My Lai.
Based on the original documents that we received as a result of our investigations.
This is General Kenneth Hodgson. He's the chief prosecutor in the United States Army at the time.
It was a massacre. It was a violation of all the rules of land warfare that I've ever known in my life, because it was this cold-blooded killing of people who appeared to be defenseless civilians.
But the prosecutors misjudged public opinion. Attitudes to Kelly in particular reflected a growing hostility to the prosecution of My Lai veterans.
Now, this is Kelly in a suit and tie going to speak at some VFW event. And the way Callie's being held up is not as a murderer, not as a guy who put women and children in a ditch and machine gunned them, as he's being held up now as a scapegoat for the war in Vietnam that's gone wrong.
I can say is thank you all very much, each and every one of you that has supported me, and also those that are supporting the men still over in Vietnam and the United States Army. Thank you very much.
There's a change in the public attitude. Now they say, wait a minute, you shouldn't be prosecuting soldiers for just carrying out their duties. All of a sudden, the public sentiment had swung the other direction. And when Callie's sentence was announced, his conviction and sentence was announced, there was an outcry.
Of the 46 men who were seriously investigated for crimes at My Lai, William Kelly was the only man ever convicted.
How crazy is that? Only one ever convicted of anything.
Today, Kelly runs a jewelry shop in Columbus, Georgia. He does not give interviews about My Lai. At his trial, these were his last words of explanation to his judges.
And when you hear these words, just they're so bullshit. They're so bullshit they make you want to vomit.
If I was committed a crime, the only crime that I have committed is in judgment of my values. Apparently, I valued my troops' lives more than I did that of the enemy.
The enemy? You mean those women and children that you murdered?
When my troops were getting massacred and mauled by an enemy.
Massacred. They'd been there 7 weeks. They had 3 KIA at this point.
I couldn't see, I couldn't feel, and I couldn't touch. That nobody in the military system ever described as anything other than communism.
You know what? Listen, hear how emotional he is. Are you shitting me?
They didn't give it a race. They didn't give it a sex. They didn't give it an age. They never let me believe it was just a philosophy in a man's mind. And that was my enemy out there. And when it became between me and that enemy, I had to value the lives of my troops.
That's right. That's why I machine gunned all those women and children in the ditch, because I valued the lives of my troops.
And I feel that is the only crime I have committed.
As Hackward said, what a piece of shit, you know? What a piece of shit.
William Calley served only 3 days in jail before being released by President Nixon into house arrest pending appeal.
And the footnote to that is his girlfriend, house arrest, PX privileges, go wherever you want on Fort Benning, I believe it was, living in guest quarters there with his girlfriend, visiting him as often as he cared to.
3 years after his original life sentence, he was released on parole, a free man.
It's why I'm old before my time. I remember it all the time. I'm all alone and life is hard. Thinking about it made me old. I won't forgive. I hate them very much. I won't forgive as long as I live. I think of the babies being killed and then ask me why I hate them. My old mother lying dead over there. I hate them.
Wish I could bring them back, but I can't. God has to forgive us, but the damage was already done. When we went in there with a purpose. And deep down we felt what we were doing was right. But after it was over, everyone knew it was wrong. And the damage was already done. It was too late.
They shouldn't shoot the innocent. Don't shoot innocent people. Let them kill their enemies. But here we were killed. In the middle of a meal, just chewing food, and we were killed. Rapists who could cut open a vagina inspired an unfading hatred. Those innocent people did nothing wrong. Those Americans so strong and valiant. Yet they raped, killed, and destroyed everything. And we just had to accept it. Now my people hate the Americans. We'll hate them as long as we live. What cruelty.
How can you forgive?
All right, we're going to hear, there's about, I don't know, about another 8 minutes of this. And then,
okay, forget.
And then Bob Nielsen's going to join us. So this is what you're going to hear now is incredibly heavy stuff. Simpson's son is killed and he talks about it right here. And he says it's God's, revenge against him.
I can't forgive myself for the things, even though I know it was something that I did and something that I was told to do. But how can I forgive that? I forgive. I can't. I live with it every day.
It's easier for you to say, well, you go ahead with your life. But how can you go ahead with your life when this is holding you back? How can I can't put my mind to anything positive because it's always negative?
When I'm very sad, I often think of starting a new life somewhere else, but it would just be the same anywhere in my country. Here is where I belong. The grave of my mother and loved one is my consolation. That's why I can never leave.
These people were tortured by this. They were kids, 18, 19 years old. Most of them had never been away from home before they went to the service. And they end up in Vietnam. And in a moment, following orders in a context in which they've been trained, prepared to follow orders, they do what they're told, and they shouldn't have, and they look back a day later and realize that they probably made the biggest mistake of their life.
It's interesting. Now, this is the second person saying, a day later, you read more statements and more, and hear, listen to more interviews. They knew immediately after doing this that what they did was wrong.
There are only a few people who were in those circumstances who had the presence of mind and the strength of their own character that would see them through that circumstance. Most people didn't. And for most of them, even people that I personally just was stunned to discover that they'd made the wrong choice, they did. And they had to live with it. They have to live with it. And so do I. So do we all.
There's a part of me that's kind and gentle. There's another part of me that's evil and destructive. Very evil and destructive. There's more destructiveness in my mind than goodness. There's more wanting to kill or to hurt than to love or to care. I don't let anyone get close to me. The loving feeling or the caring feeling is not there.
That was caused by Mila, isn't it?
That was caused by Mila.
The noise that you hear in the background is him constantly tapping his toe. You see his knee going up and down. He's got a Kleenex in his hand. He's tapping his knee with the Kleenex. And then you see bottles of drugs on the table in front of him. And then a picture of his son that he's going to talk about here momentarily on the table next to him.
My little boy playing in my grandmother's front yard here in Jackson. At his grandmother's house. There were some teenagers across the street, got into an argument. It was 14 and 15. And one went home and got a gun. And the other one just ran in the direction where my little boy was playing. And he shot. He shot him in the head. I was in the house. And I came out and picked him up. But he was already dead. He was dying. So when I looked at him, his face looked like the same face of a child that I had killed. And I said, this is the punishment for me killing the people that I killed. And when the picture that I had, when I had his funeral, the guy back from the funeral that night, that's the way it cracked. And I left it like that.
The glass is cracked right diagonally in the picture, on the, you know, of the frame, not the frame, but of the glass, and he left it there. Now, to me, the reason, and the reason, you know, this discussion about keep your honor clean and leadership at the point of confrontation, this is what you live with. This is what echoes through eternity. These are the things that you go through. His little boy is killed, and he believes it's God's intervention against him for what he did in Vietnam. It's incredible, raw, brutal shit. But it's what It's what people that are going to go fight need to see. And I question, why didn't I see this? Why didn't somebody show me this and rub my face in it? You want a reason to do the right thing? Let me take you on a trip.
That's correct.
How much of this stuff do you have?
I take 1,200 milligrams every 4 hours, four times a day, of drugs and medication. I have to take it. I need it. That's the only thing to help me somewhat stable. Not as nervous. I stay nervous, even with the medication. But if I don't take it, I go. I just go off. Just keep me under control. It helps me. Because if I don't, I may do something to someone. Even though I still have a tendency to think that of hurting someone. But the medication helps me, really helps me. But I have to take a lot of it. And it's strong, you know. It's very strong.
Do you think this really dreadful condition that you're in, this terrible life that you're leading, do you think it's ever going to come to an end?
Yeah, when I kill myself. It ought to come to an end. Like I said, I tried suicide 3 times. Maybe the good Lord is not ready for me to go. Because I could have been dead with all the stuff I had taken and tried to. But eventually, it's not out of my mind. Like I'm sitting talking to you now. I can't promise that when you come again, I'll be here. Because before you came, I had to get out of the hospital from trying suicide for the 3rd time.
The good Lord doesn't appear to have treated you very well to have put you through all this.
I still believe in him. But I guess life, you live a life for a reason, for a purpose. Now what that purpose is to have me still here, I don't know.
Are you ashamed or sorry for what you've done?
Yes, I'm ashamed. I'm sorry. I'm guilty. But I did it. Now, what else can I tell you? It happened. You're looking at someone that did. It can happen if you go to war. Those are the type of things that will happen and can happen to anyone. After they train you, they program you. It can happen. It happens. That's reality. That's what war is. War is not something that I shoot at you shoot at me. Well, we take time out. You know, well, don't shoot me here, don't shoot me there. The war is war. It's killing all type of ways. And that's where we don't need another war.
All right, we're going to take a break. Bob Nielsen is going to join us next. And we're going to talk about Vietnam through the eyes of and not Vietnam so much, but My Lai, through the eyes of somebody who fought in Vietnam. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.